Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on how did the races come through the flood, right after this. You know, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe Lyell's principles don't even know who it was that originated them. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all natural processes back through time indefinitely. Catastrophes, like Noah's flood, for instance, are strictly ruled out, and this process is called science. Well, listen to this. Let's take a look at Niagara Falls. This famous waterfall is a magnificent example of a geologic clock, a clock that reveals a very young Earth. And that's because the rim of the falls is wearing back at a known rate every year. And geologists recognize that it has only taken about 5,000 years to erode from its original precipice. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the extinction of the dinosaurs? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? Now, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And this is just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the guise of science. And this is one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. For more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, I said last time we'd take a look at Harry Rimmer. This is another neat book on science, creation science. It's called The Harmony of Science and Scripture, published in 1936, written by Harry Rimmer. That's Harry, R-I-M-M-E-R, scientist. Published by William B. Erdman Publishing Company, Grand Rapids, Michigan. This book's been out of print for so long that you'll have to get it in a used bookstore, but there's copies of it all over America. He sold thousands of them. It was reprinted in 56, 58, 62, and 64, originally published back in 1936. And it's a dynamite book. It's not very big. It's, you know, probably 300 pages, not even. And it's a small book, and it's easy to read. And he starts off here, a second factor, he says. Now, remember, we're talking about the origin of the human race. Where did the races, we got three races, Oriental, Black, and White, where did these three races come from if they came through the flood with eight people on the ark? That's the subject matter of this week's program. Well, the Rimmer sheds a little more to, or a little more information here on the mystery of where did these races come from. On page 204, he says the second factor in the problem is found in the size of the load. This factor is as variable as the factor of capacity. The exact number of animals which were carried in the ark can never be determined by science. There may have been more kinds of animals living back then. Certainly, there could not have been any less than are now extant today. Birds, cattle, creeping things are the only orders mentioned. The others are all grouped under the head of every living thing of all flesh. Of the animals classified as clean, there were to be 14, 7 male and 7 female. Of the other or unclean animals, there were to be one pair, a male and a female of each. Noah was not under the necessity of finding room in his ark for every variety and every specimen of animal and bird that we see alive today. As soon as we see this problem of the ark is simplified tremendously, the specific command is of each kind. Now, a kind is a species, and it may be generally described as those which can crossbreed with fertility. Between any two kinds, there is a line of demarcation closely drawn, and none may cross that line. We call that the law of biogenesis. The living things which can crossbreed or hybridize with fertility are all related to that genus or kind, and undoubtedly arose from the same parent ancestral stock. The myriad varieties of each kind that we see about us today have come by the process of mutation. What? What, you say? Is not this then evolution? No, this is not evolution. Evolution is transmutation. And as long as the mutant or variant or variety under discussion does not cross that line of demarcation and becomes some other kind, it is just development and growth. There is a tendency to variation within the boundary of every species. The law of Mendel is based upon observations of this process of variation. As a very common example of this process, we might cite the dahlia. The dahlia reproduces from a root clump, which is erroneously called a bulb. This root clump of the dahlia reproduces true to its type. For instance, if you have red dahlias in your garden this year, and you save the root clumps to plant the following season, from the root clumps of the red dahlia, you will get red dahlias of that type and of that variety. But the dahlia also produces seeds. Now, when you plant the seeds from a red dahlia, you may get a dozen different colors of dahlia, none of which will be red. Of these mutants or variants, about 2% will fix themselves as a new type and develop a root clump that is established. Thus, new varieties of dahlia are added to the market from year to year. You will note, however, that these new dahlias remain dahlias. They do not become onions or potatoes or tomatoes. They are always dahlias. And as long as the dahlia produces new varieties of dahlia and not something else, we're dealing with a mutation, not a transmutation. When the dahlia, by an infinite number of changes, produces something which is not a dahlia, we will then have a case of transmutation. So far as the records of science go, this process of transmutation has never occurred. There are no documented examples of transmutation. Now then, if Noah took into his ark a pair of a pure strain of every available creature, the varieties would have arisen by the process of mutation. A typical case in point may be the bee. There are many, many different varieties of bees, but Noah would have to take only a fertile queen into the ark, for her progeny could in turn give rise to all of the other varieties of bees. This statement has been objected to on the ground that the queen bee does not care for or raise her own brood, but this work is done by the workers of the hive. Well, that is unquestionably the present condition. That's what we observe today. But how did the first pair of bees raise their young? If we admit that the bees were created, like all other creatures, then there was a male and a female called the queen. And from this pair came all of the bees. Now, if you insist that the bees evolved out of some other lower insect, then the problem remains exactly the same. There was a first true bee, and that first true bee had to perpetuate its kind. Now, there's a species of ant known as the Atta ant, of whom Beebe has written so engagingly in his book, The Edge of the Jungle. These ants have a queen who lays the eggs from which the workers hatch and rear the young. But when the Atta queen is starting a new colony, the queen begins all by herself, laying the eggs and rearing the young unaided, until she has enough workers reared to take over the task, after which she then degenerates into a mere egg-laying machine. It is evident that the first bees must have had some such method of procedure such as this. Now, another case may be the dogs. If Noah took the original strain of dogs into the ark, a male and a female, this pair of dogs would then give rise to the other varieties of dogs. From one pair of canines, the process of mutation would soon produce all of the many different varieties of dogs so familiar now, and it is not too much to say that the present varieties of man and each other kind of living creatures could have arisen, and undoubtedly did arise, from an original pair of each kind, or genus. So, in the case of Noah, we need not crowd his ark with a pair of every known variety of dog, but just take two of the pure strain of dog, or of each species, into the ark. Now, true species are very few. Varieties are many. But even if the true species, of this true species, there are some which would not have had to enter the ark. We can see no reason why the ducks could not survive out in the rain, unless certain geological cataclysms that probably attended the deluge would make it impossible. Certainly, the rain would not drive them in. The alligators and the crocodiles can live in salt water or fresh, or they prefer a mixture of both. They prefer their diet well ripened, so they would fare very well outside of the ark. The fish would be safe outside. The barnacles could find a home on the bottom of the ark. In other words, a little analysis of the text shows that ignorance loses its battle against revelation here, for as always, reason is the champion of the latter. Now, there's a surprising facet here to Harry Rimmer's book. I recommend it highly. Harry Rimmer is a local flood advocate, not a universal flood advocate. And while his reason, his logic, and his common sense is impeccable, I marvel when I read one of these books and somebody is advocating the local flood theory. I say to myself, is this guy stupid or is he a wolf in sheep's clothing? In the case of Harry Rimmer, I don't think it's either. The guy's not stupid. The guy is not a wolf in sheep's clothing that I can tell, although there are many of those out there. So as I mentioned, in this series, oftentimes we'll have a divergent view on the interpretation of Scripture, which is predicated upon this concept of these people do not practice the law and their understanding is lacking. A good understanding of all they who do His commandments. All right, we've got to take a break here, so hang on. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his principles of geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these concepts. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. That way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are strictly ruled out, and this process, of course, is called science. Well, listen to this. When we talk about erosion, what's even more surprising is the discovery that all of the continents on Earth would be worn down to sea level in just 14 million years at the rate of erosion that we observe today going on all around us. But there's no evidence for such drastic erosion. The mountains and valleys on Earth appear to have been very recently made, and their sharp angular appearance testifies to their youthfulness, not their age. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? And that was 65 million years ago. Well, boys and girls, if you just took a look at erosion at the rate that we see it going on today, count back 14 million years and the Earth should be as smooth as a billiard ball, but it's not. Now, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on that kind of pseudo-scientific lie, and that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda masquerading under the label science. And this is one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. For more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. Call direct 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email, and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, in the last segment, I was talking about Harry Rimmer. Harry Rimmer wrote the book The Harmony of Science and Scripture, published by Erdman back in 1936. To get a copy, you need the name and the author. That is The Harmony of Science and Scripture by Dr. Harry Rimmer. Just go into any used bookstore. Tell them that's the book you want. They'll look it up and see if they've got it in their inventory. If they don't, have them click onto the internet. They will be tied into thousands of other used bookstores who have their inventory up on the web, and you'll be able to find it that way. You'll be amazed at the oddball books that you can find. That's one up. Furthermore, that book may be in stock, may be currently being published, and you could get a copy at your local Bible bookstore. Ask them there. All right, let's go back to the Genesis flood. Now, we're talking about kinds, because what's happening here is that we have mutations. Human beings mutated from Mother Eve. One of two things happened here. Mother Eve had within her body the genetic mutations, the genetic material for the other two races, and they appeared prior to the flood and were carried through the flood with these eight people, or the genetic material resided in these eight people, well, six of them. Remember, Noah and his wife were pure in their generations. We'll come to that here in a minute. One or the other. Now, there were giants on earth before the flood. Do you remember that statement in Genesis 6? There were giants on earth. Mutations had already occurred, and a race of giants had occurred prior to the flood. Now, did the giants, were they of one race, and were blacks of another race, and were orientals of a third race, and were these giants black or oriental or white? Or maybe they were purple and they were giants. They died out. Moses reports that the king of Og had a bedstead 14 feet long. In the Natural History Museum in Chicago, up until 1940, they had a giant skeleton 14 feet long. 14 feet. So Moses' account of a giant called Og with a bedstead 14 feet isn't exaggerated, because they had an actual skeleton 14 feet. Of course, 14-foot giants do not fit in with the theory of evolution, so it's been removed. I don't know what happened to it, but it's gone. But the literature had that skeleton in it. I've seen the pictures of it. Pictures, you know, taken back in the 20s and 30s of this giant skeleton. This is before evolution took hold in American thought, anthropology, science. We used to tell the truth. You see, today we cover it up. If it doesn't fit with our preconceived beliefs in evolution, we just take it off display and eliminate it. That's not science. That's propaganda. Now, let's just stick with science, because the Bible is a science book. Not only is it a law book, every scientific statement made in the Bible has been proved out to be correct. Science textbooks over the last 100 years, can you name one that's still in print? Just go back 100 years to 1904. Have you got any 1904, 1914, 24, 34, or 44 science textbooks? The science of 100 years ago is the laughingstock of today. Piltdown Man was a lying hoax. It was the science of the 1920s. Today, you don't see it. But the Bible's still here. The Bible is still telling its story. Most people don't believe it, but the Bible, every time that we check the Bible against science, the scientific statements of the Bible, while ridiculed and impugned in 1870, Pi Smith's arguments in 1870, are no longer science. Now, that's how good the Bible is. All right, now let's go back to the Genesis flood. On page 65, we read another aspect of this problem is the capacity of the ark for carrying two of every kind of land animal and seven of every clean beast, as we read in Genesis 7, verses 2 and 3. Realizing full well that the ark was a gigantic structure, advocates of the local flood have had to resort to various methods of multiplying the species in order to make it impossible for any ark, however large, to carry two of each kind. One method has been to take the phrase seven and seven in Genesis 7, verses 2 and 3, to mean 14 instead of by sevens, and to classify all of the birds of the heavens as clean. Jan Lever, professor of zoology at the Free University of Amsterdam, has done this and comes to the conclusion that of the clean animals and of the birds, there were seven pairs of the unclean, one pair, and there are known at present about 15,000 species of birds. This means that there were 210,000 birds in the ark. Well, even assuming that there were 15,000 different species of birds in the days of Noah, Dr. Lever has put 180,000 too many birds into the ark. The Hebrew phrase 7 and 7 no more means 14 than does the parallel phrase 2 and 2. In Genesis 7, 9 and 15 means 4. Furthermore, the context demands that the birds were to be classified into clean and unclean, just like the other animals. Leupold explains it this way. He says, the Hebrew expression take seven, seven means seven each. And Koenig's syntax, 85, 36, 316b, where it says, Geninius Gemmerhalk, Reverend by Ketuch, 134q, that's a citation now. Hebrew parallels support this explanation. In any case, it would be a most clumsy method of trying to say 14. Three pairs and one supernumerary make the seven. As has often been suggested, the supernumerary beast was the one Noah could conveniently offer for sacrifice after the termination of the flood. In verse 3, the idea of the birds of the heavens must, of course, be supplemented by the adjective clean, according to the principle laid down in verse 2. The birds were separately mentioned so that Noah might not be left to his own devices to fix the limits of what verse 2 included. Now, another common method of multiplying the species has been to identify the species of modern taxonomy with the kinds of genuses. John Pye Smith seemed to find much delight in pointing out that the ark was too small for such a cargo. For the innumerable millions upon millions of animalcules must be provided for they have all their appropriate and diversified places and circumstances of existence. For 100 years, a further study in the science of zoology has brought to light some interesting facts concerning the amazing potentialities for diversification, which the Creator has placed within the genus kinds. These kinds have never evolved or merged into each other by crossing over the divinely established lines of demarcation, but they have been diversified into so many varieties and subvarieties, like the races and families of humanity, that even the greatest taxonomists have been staggered at the task of enumerating and classifying them. All right, let's pause here for a second. Now, on planet Earth today, we have 200 nations, 200 members or 200 member nations of the United Nations. A nation is a family. Now, if you take a look at the race, the Orientals, they're divided into several nationalities or nations or families. A nation is simply a family of a certain type of person. Now, to you and I, when we look at Orientals, they all look alike. Well, I've been taking a little closer look at Orientals, and no, they don't all look alike any more than we whites all look alike. You know, Italians, Swiss, French, English, Germans, Swedes, you compare them with Romanians, Czechoslovakians, Russians, and there are distinct differences in those people's features. Well, they're all white, and some of them are whiter than others. Their eye colors vary. Their hair colors vary, and the way their hair attaches to their head varies. Some people have wavy hair, and some people have straight hair. Some people have red hair, blonde hair. So there are distinct differences. So if you take a look at the Japanese, they're pretty small people. Compare those to the Koreans. Compare those to the Chinese. Compare those to the Cambodians, Laotians, Mongolians, Cambodians, and so on. And then each one of these families, Orientals though they may be, they're all different. Every one of them. The Japanese will not marry or have very much to do with Chinese, Vietnamese, Cambodians, Mongoloids, or Mongols, I guess I should say, or Chinese and Koreans and so on. These people remain separate and distinct nations or nationalities of people. Now, we whites over here are divided up into many groups of people, but there's only three basic races. The giants are no longer in the game. There was a race of giants, of which we read in the scripture. Remember David and Goliath? Well, Goliath was 9 feet 6 inches tall. Pretty big guy. Probably weighed around 450 pounds if he was tall and trim, 9 foot 6. 450 pounds would be about right. But hey, listen, what do you do with a guy that's 14 feet tall? That guy should weigh in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 2,000 pounds at 14 feet. So the 14-foot giants were about the size of a Charolais cow. Charolais are about 14 feet long. And they weigh about 1,500 pounds. You know, some of them get up to a ton. You get a bull, you know, he'd be up around 2,000 pounds. So there were races of people described in the Bible who were giants. And those giants developed prior to the flood. Giants before the flood. Well, then, where did the giants come from before the flood? They had to have come out of Mother Eve. So Mother Eve obviously had the potential for other races, at least one race, giants, mentioned before the flood. And there's every reason to believe by the time we get to Genesis 10 at the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was for the express purpose of dividing the races. Everybody had one language. They were all descended from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ah. Well, Noah was pure in his generation, so it's impossible for Noah to have a black son, a brown son, and a white son. But it isn't possible, but it is not impossible, I should say. It's certainly possible for Noah's three sons to have had a white wife, an oriental wife, and a black wife. Because the scripture does not say that Noah's sons were pure in their generations. Ah. Now remember, the scripture is written, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. So we have to pull in information from other portions of the Bible. Man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Alright, so let's take a look now at the science. Frank Lewis Marsh has prepared a diagram to illustrate his conception of how some of the typical Brahmins from Bara, B-A-R-A, created, and Min, kind, Bara Min, might have become diversified before and after the flood. He points out that over 500 varieties of sweet pea have been developed from a single type since the year 1700, and that over 200 distinct varieties of dogs, as different from each other as the Dachshund and the Collie, have developed from a very few wild dogs. In further discussing the matter, Dr. Marsh writes, quote, "In the field of zoology, a very good illustration of descent with variation is furnished by the domestic pigeon. The diversity in form and temperament to be found among strains of pigeons would stagger our belief in their common origin if we did not know that they have all been developed from the wild stock pigeon of European coasts. They're called Columbia livia." Well, let's pause here for a moment. Noah went into the ark with seven pairs of pigeons, because pigeons are clean birds. Noah went into the ark with one pair of ravens. From the one pair of ravens, we have a multitude of varieties of ravens. From seven pairs of pigeons, we have a multitude of varieties of pigeons. These varieties have been built into the Genesis kinds. Mankind cannot interbreed with gorillas, chimpanzees, or orangutans. Orangutans, gorillas, and chimpanzees cannot interbreed. There is, however, a Genesis kind called donkeys, burros, and horses. These three can interbreed, and when they do, they produce an animal called a mule. The mule is a hybrid and is sterile. Leviticus 19:19 prohibits the interbreeding of these kinds of animals. It says, "You shall not let your cattle gender with a diverse kind." That's not speaking of Holstein cows breeding with Jersey cows, although that's a bad breeding practice. We avoid that, those of us in the cattle business, like AIDS, herpes, and VD. But it's not illegal. But what is illegal is the breeding of four-footed quadrupeds. And we do that today. We breed buffalo with cattle to create beefalo. We breed goats and sheep and call them geeps. Now, that's not natural, and it's prohibited in Leviticus 19:19. Now, we've gone a step further in modern science. We want to play God, and so we're now cloning animals. Cloning is illegal. It is just as prohibited in Leviticus 19:19 as breeding these mules, but, you know, we're not practicing any other of God's laws, so what's another broken law here or there? But here's the problem. These violations of laws all have a penalty. There's no such thing as a law without a penalty. If you take the wild stock of salmon, it takes 4 years to develop. We've now brought these salmon down and bred them in ponds, and we can develop these ponds with genetic engineering so that these fish will reproduce and they will mature in 2 years. But these fish don't reproduce with the numbers that the wild salmon do, and they've now gotten loose into the wild stocks. And so ultimately, they're estimating now about 20 years, all of the wild stocks of salmon will be destroyed. We'll only have the domestic, that is the genetically modified varieties of salmon, and they can't make it in the wild. They can only live in captivity and then be released into the wild and then come back. But they don't have enough eggs, so they don't produce enough in the way of numbers, and they become extinct. So salmon, over the next 20 to 40 years on planet Earth, should become extinct. Well, according to the science. And this is what we get now when we violate this law. You know, God wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat when he gave us these instructions. But, of course, men see themselves as being smarter than God. And furthermore, the main purpose of Monsanto and genetic engineering has nothing to do with religion or God or being smarter than God. It has to do with short-term profits, corporate profits, and that's why we do it. All right, now going back to the Genesis flood in figure 4, I'll describe it for you. They start off here with mankind. We've got a creation, and we have black, yellow, and white. They go back to the flood, and the races came from Seth, Ham, and Japheth. Mankind starts with just Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Now, if you trace the genealogy back, Adam and Eve were white. Just go back through their genealogy. This is offensive to black people. And it's offensive to some degree to Oriental people because they see themselves as being equal to. In other words, they don't want to see themselves as being genetic variations of Adam and Eve who were white. Black people want to see white people and Orientals as being genetic variations of black people, and they picture Adam and Eve as being black. And then, of course, the evolutionists look at that and they say, that's preposterous. Evolution is the way mankind came into being, and we came by transmutation from monkeys, gorillas, and orangutans. All right, now, that evolutionary philosophy is pure religion and philosophy. There isn't a single example of anywhere in science where we have transmutation. What we're talking about today is man intervening in man, creating genetic mutations, transmutations. Well, yeah. Well, God did that, and he set certain limits. Naturally, it won't occur, but if we intervene, we can make it occur. But that's not evolution, that's creation. When man creates a salmon, when man creates something, that's a creation, not an evolution. That isn't something coming from nothing. That's something coming from something, and it's manipulated and controlled by a super, or a, I'm going to say supernatural, but a superior intelligence, which is exactly what the scripture has been telling us from day one. A super intelligence, a superior intelligence, created the heavens and the earth. He calls himself God. You can call him whatever you want. But what we see around us, the Bible tells us, was created. It didn't just happen, and it hasn't always existed. And the two laws of thermodynamics put to rest this concept of the eternal, or the eternity of mass and matter. Mass and matter is running down. It's degenerating. It's going out of existence. Matter is not now coming into existence. This is a clock. It was wound up. It's running. It isn't wound down. And it isn't fully wound up, as is evidenced by looking at the sun. The sun's running down at the rate of 5 feet an hour. Now, when we look at dogs, for instance, dogs come from fox-like varieties, dog-like varieties, and hyena-like varieties. And they developed from a pair of wild dogs. So foxes, dogs, and hyenas have now gone into Arctic fox, gray foxes, and red foxes, wolves, dogs, and coyotes, jackals, and hyenas. In other words, what we're looking at here are varieties. Now, the most logical observation that we can make, based upon what we see, and we'll take this up in the last hour when we take a look at Genesis 6, 7, and 8. We'll take those three chapters and I'll take them apart. And we'll go through those scriptures line by line. And we will delineate out what the Bible tells us. And what the Bible tells us about race and race relations. You know, race is a pretty big topic. And it causes a lot of hate and discontent. So at the Tower of Babel, God took a look at this and he said, you know, races cannot live together. And it's possibly, and even probably, the cause of all of the violence that was going on in the world prior to the flood. Remember, God said the world or the earth was filled with violence. Well, if those people before the flood are anything like people today, when we got it in our heads a couple of hundred years ago, 300 years ago, that we were going to amalgamate all these races, that we would bring these black Africans here to North America and use them as slaves, it was a fatal decision. It was fateful, number one, and it was fatal, number two. You know, when God gave China to the Chinese, and he gave Africa to the blacks, and he gave Europe to the Europeans, and he gave the Americas to the Indians, these races and subtypes or sub-races that have developed over time weren't an aberration and they weren't a mistake. God knew what he was doing and he did it for a reason. There's nothing wrong with blacks, nothing wrong with Orientals, nothing wrong with Indians. It's just that they can't live together. So he put the Chinese over in Asia and built a big mountain barrier, separated us by oceans, gave us our estates, gave us our inheritances, and said, this is the way I want you to live. This is where I want you to live. Primarily, it's the white man that has interfered with the white man, the Anglo-Saxon Israelites. You know, we're the guys that gave the finger to our God and said, no, God, you're wrong. We're going to go out here and straighten out all your mistakes. We're going to fix it. So we went to Africa, scoffed up those Africans, and brought them over here. You got them in England now. You got them in North America. How do you like it? How's it working out? We have had nothing but race problems and riots, hatred and discontent on both sides from that day to this. You know it as well as I do. So the concept of trying to meld these races together and create this homogenized race of people, you know, that, well, gee, why can't all these people just live together? What we'll do is educate them. Okay, get out there, you school teachers, and educate us all about race, and let's see how it works out, will you? Hasn't worked yet, and I kind of doubt that it's going to work in the future. All right, hang on. We got to take a break here. We'll be right back with more on races and how they got through the flood right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, let's take a look at one last item over here before we take a look at the step-by-step sequence of events that occurs in Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9. Going back to the Genesis flood again, it's unwarranted to insist that all of the present species, not to mention all of the varieties and sub-varieties of animals in the world today, were represented in the ark. Nevertheless, as a gigantic barge with a volume of 1,396,000 cubic feet, assuming one cubit at 17.5 inches, which is the smallest cubit that's known, the ark had a carrying capacity equal to that of 522 standard stock cars, as used by modern railroads, or of 8 freight trains with 65 cars each. Ernest Mayr, probably the leading American systematic taxonomist, lists the following numbers for animal species according to the best estimates of modern taxonomy. In the world today, mammals occupy about 3,500 varieties, birds 8,600, reptiles and amphibians 5,500, fishes 18,000, tunicates 1,700, that's marine animals, echinoderms, starfish, etc., 4,700. Anthropods, apes, that's 815,000. That includes all the monkeys. Mollusks, soft shell, 88,000. Worms, 25,000. Coleopterates, that is, invertebrates, 10,000. Sponges, 5,000. Protozoans, single cell, 15,000. For a total of about 1 million different animals on planet Earth. In the light of this recent estimate, one wonders about the innumerable millions upon millions of animalcules which Pye Smith insisted that the ark had to carry, especially when we consider that of this total, there was no need for Noah to take or make any provision for fishes, 18,000. Marine chordates like sea squirts, 1,700. Marine creatures like starfish and sea urchins, 4,700. Mollusks such as mussels, clams, and oysters, 88,000. Corals and sea anemones, jellyfish, and hydroids, 10,000. Sponges, 5,000. Or protozoans, which are microscopic single-cell creatures, mostly marine, 15,000. Now, this eliminates 143,000 species of marine creatures. In addition, some mammals are aquatic, such as whales, seals, and porpoises. The amphibians need not all have been included, and a large number of the arthropods, 815,000 species, such as lobsters, shrimps, crabs, water fleas, barnacles, are marine creatures, and the insect species among the arthropoda are usually very small, and many of the 25,000 species of worms, as well as many of the insects, could have survived outside of the ark. So when we consider further that Noah was not required to take the largest or even the adult specimens of each kind, for instance, he didn't have to take a pair of mature elephants, he could take two juveniles, and that comparatively few were classified as clean birds and beasts, the problem simply vanishes. Jan Lever completely misses the mark when he states that the lowest estimate of the number of animals in the ark would be fully 2,500,000. For all practical purposes, one could say that at the outside there was need for no more than 35,000 individual vertebrate animals on the ark. Now, the total number of so-called species of mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians listed by Mayer is 17,600, but undoubtedly the number of original kinds was less than this. Assuming the average size of these animals to be about that of a sheep, there are only a very few really large animals, you know, like whales and elephants and giraffes. And of course, even these could have been represented on the ark by young ones, that is, a pair of juvenile giraffes and a pair of juvenile elephants. And we don't need any whales at all. The following will give an idea of the accommodations available. The number of animals per car varies greatly depending on the size and age of the animals. But reports of stock cars and railroads show that the average number of meat animals to the carload is for cattle about 25, hogs in a single deck car about 75, and sheep about 120 per deck. This means then that at least 240 animals of the size of sheep would be accommodated in a standard two-decked stock car. Two trains hauling 73 cars each would thus be ample to carry the 35,000 animals, and we've already seen that the ark had a carrying capacity equivalent to that of 522 stock cars of this size. We therefore find that a few simple calculations with arithmetic dispose of this objection once and for all. So with respect to the universal, or the survival of plants through the flood, we have this comment from Walter E. Lemertz, consultant in the Horticultural Research Division of Germain Seed Company, Incorporated. He said, "I'm convinced that many thousands of plants survived either as floating vegetation rafts or by chance burial near enough to the surface of the ground for asexual sprouting of new shoots." And I am, of course, aware that objections could be raised on the idea that long exposure to salt water would be so harmful to any vegetation as to either kill it or to reduce its vitality as to make root and new shoot formation impossible. However, I see no reason at all to postulate that the salt content of the ocean at the time of the flood was as high as it is now. In fact, on the basis of the canopy theory, we would most certainly expect that the salt content of the ocean before the flood would be diluted, perhaps by one half. We have no knowledge of the saline constituency of the oceans prior to the flood. It may be that they were all freshwater, such as we see in the Great Lakes today. Naturally, during the first few hundred years after the flood, the salt content of the ocean would again be rather rapidly raised because of the much above normal drainage off of the land surface. Marsh further suggests that there was doubtless a considerable number of plants which were carried through the flood in the form of seeds, which composed a portion of the large store of food catched on the ark. But most of the vegetation sprang up here and there wherever the propagules were able to survive the flood. Which now takes us up to the caring for the animals in the ark, and that's not part of our interest or our question here. Again, if you want to take a look at geology and how the animals were cared for on the ark and whether or not Noah and eight people total could care for 35,000 animals, that's another story for another day. Let me refer you again to these two science textbooks which deal with this question. One is called The Harmony of Science and Scripture by Harry Rimmer, and the other, The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris, is where I went to get the information. These two books, by the way, are not the only books on the subject. I probably here in my library have 10 that I know of, which deal with science from the creation perspective. About 54% of scientists, at least here in the United States, I presume it probably carries worldwide, but about 54% in the, or, yeah, I think it's 54%, believe in evolution, do not believe in the Bible, do not believe in special creation. About 46% of scientists worldwide believe in special creation, believe in the Bible, or believe in some aspect or segment of the Bible. Even the limited flood theorists, both religion and secular, will say, well, we do believe there's a God, and that creation and special creation is probably the best explanation for the origin of mass, matter, and biology. So it's about evenly divided, about 50-50, it's 54-46. Out of the scientists and others, biologists, geologists, and so on, that are of the special creation bent, many of those people have written books, such as The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris, but none of this literature ever shows up in public educational institutions. You never see these in public high schools. You'll never see these in colleges and universities. They're not allowed there. So even though the opinion concerning God and special creation and no God and evolution is about evenly divided among experts, scientists, 99, in fact, I'll go so far as to say 100% of all of the literature is anti-God and anti-special creation. If there is any special creation in any public institution, I've never heard of it and don't know about it. It's political in nature. It's a mindset. It's a religion. It's a political ideology and religion based upon socialism, communism. It's a philosophy. It's anti-God. It's anti-Bible. It has an anti-supernaturalistic bias that's built in. Now, all of the information that you're going to find on special creation is going to be in such books as The Genesis Flood and The Harmony of Science and Scripture. There's a fellow by the name of Kent Hovind. I don't have his website. I think if you just plugged in the name Hovind, H-O-V-I-N-D, Kent, you'd probably come up with his website. He's an anti-evolutionary Baptist preacher who is probably the best source of this kind of information. And I'm sure that he has a lot of good science and scientific information books and periodicals and so on that you can get through him and his website. Another guy is Carl Baugh. He has a museum down in Glen Rose, Texas. I think if you put in Glen Rose, Texas, or Baugh, B-A-U-G-H, Carl, you'd probably find that. I've picked up a lot of books from these two guys. Not published by these two guys, but books that are published by other scientists and other disciplines that you can look further into the sciences and evolutionary philosophy and the bankrupt philosophy of evolution. All right, we're about to the end of this. We got one more hour to go. The last hour we will devote to races and Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9. We'll go through them in a little more detail when we finish this series of seven programs on where did the races come from, how did they get through the flood. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact discs, so for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives that can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All right, there's the signal. It says my time is up. I got to leave it right there. So I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, for the conclusion of this series. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.